Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, having a turkey for Christmas dinner is an important tradition in most Irish households, but did you know that in days gone by, the ultimate Christmas dinner for many Irish homes was beef and plum pudding together? I'm joined by Regina Sexton, food and culinary historian and programme manager of the Masters in Food Studies in University College Cork. Good morning, Regina.
Good morning, Colm.
Beef and plum pudding together as a Christmas dinner seems an unusual idea, but we'll come back to that in a moment, because let's just look first. In the past, the time of the year had an influence on what people were eating in a way maybe that isn't the same today.
Yeah, that's it exactly. And I suppose the big word there that comes to mind is the idea of different seasons and seasonality. But if you think about, and I suppose we're a bit separated from it now at the moment for various different reasons, but if you think about the natural world and what's happening in the natural world at the moment, the sun is kind of a bit far away. We don't have as much of it as we would like to have at this time. Agriculture is, in a traditional agricultural economy now, I mean, agriculture is a bit slack, and essentially the world is a little bit gone to sleep. So things are calmed down. The light is something that we desire to have. So we bring light in, we light up the darkness, and we try to bring a bit, I suppose, of what we look forward to in the summer months. We bring a bit of the green world into the house as well. And in that sense, I suppose, you know, there's a great folk line that at Easter, for Easter there's new clothes, but for Christmas there's food. And in that sense, I suppose, what people are thinking about is that it's a bit miserable out there. It's a bit calmed down. So what better thing to do than to maybe look at all the foods that we have saved from the fertile part of the year and just have a feast, have a big party, and try and fight the darkness and bring the light into that in various different ways.
All right. And I suppose as well as the environmental influences you're talking about outside, there's also a spiritual or religious dimension to marking the time of the year.
It's kind of fascinating, really, because if you look at it, you know, we can layer then culture. Culture comes upon the natural world, I suppose, in various different layers. So there's different layers of culture. And one of the big ones, of course, is religion, be that pre-Christian or Christian. And then, of course, we go into Catholicism and so on. So, you know, there's a big imprint of faith and piety at this time of the year, because if you think about the season, that the liturgical season at the moment, we're in Advent, and that would have happened after St. Martin's Day on the 11th of November, Martimus, and then it goes into Advent, which brings us up to Christmas. And in that liturgical season, there was a sense of maybe restraint and holding back and reflection, kind of the equivalent of the Lent for Christmas, if you like, so that people were sort of reflecting before the big religious festival of Christmas Day itself. And there's a sense of control, I suppose, around consumption in that regard as well. And fish would have played a big part in those 4 weeks of Advent leading up to Christmas. And then on Christmas Eve, there's this kind of the tension between fish and meat. Christmas Eve traditionally would have been celebrated with a fish dinner, and usually in Ireland it would have been a heavily salted fish, like salted cod or ling, wrasse in some parts of Ireland, particularly on the coast. So that marked the end of that liturgical season, and then the meat season started, if you like, on the following day.
Right, and meat kind of being a sign of abundance, of wealth in some respects, and this culture of feasting goes right back hundreds of years. It's pretty ancient.
Oh, of course it is, yeah. And, you know, feasting. People come together to feast for various different reasons. And, I mean, it's almost an institution, I suppose, in some, again, I'm talking about sort of early societies and early agrarian societies, where feasting is something to bring people together, but also to bring them together for reciprocal reasons. You know, that the Lord would give a feast and he would expect loyalty from the retainers in that regard. And food is sort of the fuel, the lubricant that keeps those relationships going. And in order to demonstrate power in that instance, food is brilliant, because you can be very flamboyant, ostentatious, and that's where we get the sort of the remnants of that which we do today as well. Things like extravagant displays at the table, like big birds, lots of meat, and profusion of meat, diversity of meat. So meat, the idea of the big bird and how it's displayed at the table. I mean, you hear all of these stories about the medieval feasts of serving peacock and swan, heron and crane, depending on where you are. And of course, what happens is that through time, this little thread of ostentatious display carries on. And we still do it today. You know, we're all out now mad looking for big birds, be it a turkey or a goose, depending on taste, I suppose. And then we come to the table and there is a flurry of sort of arrival that we present this big bird to the table. And there's a sense of, you know, awe and expectation in that regard. And that's really connecting back to these elements of medieval feasting and this idea of ostentatious display.
We've kind of toned down the decorations, though, have we, of the big bird. We're done with the feather thing.
Maybe
you'd give listeners a sense of how the bird used to be dressed.
Yeah, and, you know, just to make apologies in advance for the sensitive nature of it, but the birds would be cooked, things like swans and peacocks. But before they were cooked, their skin and feathers would be taken off in one piece. The bird would be cooked, and then it went through a process of what they call re-armaturing, where the skin and the feather was put back onto the cooked bird. So when it's brought to the table, it looks like a swan has arrived, or a peacock with its fan of glorious feathers has arrived to the table.
I can hear the Food Safety Authority ringing in here in the background already. Camille, at the outset I said that beef and plum pudding served together in the pre-turkey era. How did that combo come about?
Yeah, so, and again, this is a bit of a thread back to different palates and different tastes, where sweet and savoury would have been served at the same in the same dishes, and that would have separated when you get the separation of sweet and savoury that we kind of practice today. But yeah, so, you know, if you read some of the older cookery books that come online, particularly the big upsurge in cookery books in the 18th century, you see that there are certain dishes that are kind of tied to the festival. So one of the dishes that's tied to the festival is beef. And then the other things that are tied to the festival are plum pudding or plum porridge, which was an earlier version of it, and mince pies. And in many instances, these would have been served together. So the beef and the pudding would have been served together. There's this glorious illustration from 1800, well, produced in 1830, a display called Christmas Day of Farmer Giles. It's an English illustration. But at the table there's this idea of, you know, people coming together to share food. And the two big dishes you can see at their table is a huge side, a sirloin of beef on the bone, and an equally huge ball, globe of Christmas plum pudding. And the two of those are going to be served together.
All right. I suppose there's suet in plum pudding and mince pies as well. So there was kind of crossover on the ingredients as well, wasn't there?
There was, of course. And I suppose the thing I didn't say about Martinmas was that, again, in the traditional agricultural frame, this was a time when farmers and agricultural societies would cull back their stocks. So animals would have been slaughtered. The meat would have been preserved and saved. So there is this kind of surplus of ingredients, the offcuts, not the best cuts like the sirloin, which is now very good at this time of the year. But there's the offcuts like the offal pieces, the bone and the fat and the suet, like you said. And all of those go into dishes that are associated with Christmas. Plum porridge would have started off with a base of a shin of beef boiled down into a broth. The fat and the suet goes into the mince pies. And so there's other kind of families of pies as well that have loads of kind of a beef base or a veal base or thongs. So the thong was the base of thong was a really desirable piece of offal. That was the base for a lot of the mince pies at this point in time.
Right.
So you have that connecting up of agriculture, religion, the environment and seasonality in the form and the expression of a feast at this time of the year.
So how did we end up gobbling turkeys?
This is really interesting because, of course, the turkey isn't the turkey is from the Americas. So this has to be brought back to Europe via the old world going to the new world. So the turkey comes back to Europe. And so too, like for Ireland, of course, you have things like the potato and, of course, sugar being the big one. But the turkey comes into Europe. And the thing about the turkey is that it's another big bird. So it's another big bird to join onto the other kind of collections of big birds like the peacocks and the swans and so on. But the thing about the turkey is that it fattens very successfully. So it develops lots of meat on the carcass in contrast to the other big birds. So this becomes more desirable because you've more meat on it. And of course, as you filter down through the social hierarchies, having a turkey makes good economic sense. And of course, then in Ireland, what happens is, well, in other places too, but if we're talking about Ireland, you know, the turkey becomes something that farming women will rear for Christmas and sell them on to the Christmas markets, making a lot of money, good money, pin money to bring back into the household. And in some instances, the women would sell the turkeys off and see these as commodities, you know, commercial units. So they make the money from the turkeys and they might enjoy a goose themselves then for Christmas instead of the turkey.
Right. So we have turkeys coming from America. Presumably the connection, the fact that Ireland itself was a British colony as well, and the spuds coming back from there. I mean, how many colonial imprints are there on people's Christmas dinner? Not that we want to make them feel bad about eating.
Well,
it at this
I suppose
stage.
That's what I always say. The Christmas, you know, the traditional elements of the Christmas dinner, I divide them up into three things. There's the meat, the pudding, and the pie. And these are quintessential elements, features of British foodways. And these have been directly imported and assimilated into Irish foodways at Christmas. So we celebrate very much an English Christmas, if you like. But then into that, inserted, injected, are the interesting elements of colonisation as well, in terms of the spices coming from far away. And of course, the sugar, which is crucial to Christmas and all the sweetness around that, that coming, of course, as a product of colonisation as well. So that's what I think is really fascinating about Christmas, is that you have these layers of different expressions of culture, I suppose, if you like, on it. And we still do it, you know, we still kind of remember all of those things.
Right. The pig is the patriot in the mix, is it?
Oh, sure. Look, the pig has served us so well. And
the pig died for Ireland. Come here to me. When did Christmas become such a commercial affair? People, it's the annual grumble, but you know, it didn't start yesterday.
It didn't. No, it didn't. And I suppose, you know, once you have a mercantile economy and you move on to a more kind of capital-based, I suppose, economy with globalization elements and so on, Christmas has always been commercialized, and it's I think people want to bring in, you know, and it's going back to this idea of safety and comfort, celebration at this dismal time of the year. So people want to have a profusion and diversity of things. And of course, the market is going to take advantage of those. So the big, you know, the big step over into commercialism happens in the, it happens before this, but there's a big upsurge in the 19th century when you have, you know, the commercialization of food gets an upsurge anyway from various different sort of scientific and technological advances and the opening of free markets, particularly in the second half of the 19th century. But it happens before that too.
Right. And back to colonialism, aren't we? The British Empire is booming. There's money washing around, and there's, you know, people are going to cash in on the advantage.
They are, of course, and people are going to aspire to that type of Christmas as well, if you have the money to do it. And depending on where you are, you know, if you're in Dublin, George in Dublin or Cork or the big cities, you're going to have the suppliers providing an endless diversity of luxury goods for you. That might be a bit different than to the Irish rural Christmas, for instance, but still the desire there to bring in elements of meat. And not just, you know, you talked about the turkey and the ham. It's not just turkey. It has to be turkey and ham, or it has to be turkey and ham and spiced beef. Do you know, there's a diversity of the one element, and then you have all the spicy things and the sweet things.
And tell us about Mary Laverty, or Maura Laverty, should I say, and the idea of the Christmas dinner, this picture we have of turkey, ham and all the trimmings. What influence did she have on it?
Well, yeah, I was looking at Maura Laverty worked for the ESB, particularly as you were going through the Rural Electrification Scheme in the 20th century. But I looked at her menu for Christmas Day dinner, which would be into the 50s, even though it would have been set throughout the 19th century and into the early decades of the 20th century as well. But like her menu from the 1950s is kind of what we would look upon as being the kind of the package of Christmas foods. So she has a starter, celery soup, or tomato soup or bouillon. And actually celery is the accompaniment to, in many instances, is the sauce accompaniment to turkey as well. So then she has either the turkey or the goose. There you go, the meat elements. With veal force meat, even though this is made with ham, if you look at the recipe. And various different types of stuffing. She has different types of stuffing for the turkey and the goose. And the ham is in there with a very sweet sweet sauce made with Madeira as the base and honey. And then she has Brussels sprouts. They're in there. Giblet gravy, riced potatoes, bread sauce, you know. And then she finishes up, not with just one dessert, but the whole collection of them, pudding, mince pies and trifle. And then, sure, if that wasn't enough, there's the Christmas cake, the eggnog, the chocolate log and the Gaelic coffee.
All right. And a kip on the couch to round it all off, no doubt. OK, Regina Sexton, food and culinary historian and programme manager of the Masters in Food Studies in University College Cork. Thanks for joining us. Happy Christmas to you.
Get in touch on WhatsApp 0870 32 32 32.